You are listening to the IFH Podcast Network. For more amazing filmmaking and screenwriting podcasts, just go to ifhpodcastnetwork.com.
Welcome to the Bulletproof Screenwriting Podcast, episode number 188. A hero need not speak. When he is gone, the world will speak for him. Halo.
Broadcasting from a dark, windowless room in Hollywood, when we really should be working on that next draft. It's the Bulletproof Screenwriting Podcast, showing you the craft and business of screenwriting while teaching you how to make your screenplay bulletproof. And here's your host, Alex Ferrari.
Welcome, welcome to another episode of the Bulletproof Screenwriting Podcast. I am your humble host, Alex Ferrari. Now, today's show is sponsored by Bulletproof Script Coverage. Now, unlike other script coverage services, Bulletproof Script Coverage actually focuses on the kind of project you are and the goals of the project you are. So we actually break it down by three categories: micro-budget, indie film market, and studio film. There's no reason to get coverage from a reader that's used to reading tentpole movies when your movie's going to be done for $100,000. And we wanted to focus on that at Bulletproof Script Coverage. Our readers have worked with Marvel Studios, CAA, WME, NBC, HBO, Disney, Scott Free, Warner Brothers, The Blacklist, and many, many more. So if you need your screenplay or TV script covered by professional readers, head on over to covermyscreenplay.com. Today's show is also sponsored by Indie Film Hustle Pro, our private and growing community for filmmakers and screenwriters. It was created for film creatives like you to meet, network, and support each other, learn from film industry experts, and to get the answers to your burning questions and more. The journey in this business is rough. There is no guarantee to success, but your chances of reaching your goals dramatically improve when you find others who are on the same journey as you and you work together towards a common goal. That is why I put together IFH Pro. Inside, you'll get professional networking, private and safe spaces to discuss the film business, access to advanced tools and education, up-to-date education, exclusive content not available publicly, access to IFH Pro workshops, webinars, special guests, and so, so much more. If you want to check it out, head over to indiefilmhustle.com/pro. Well, guys, you are in for a treat today. We have writer, director, and showrunner Stephen Kane. Now, Stephen's been writing in Hollywood for years. He has written for Major Crimes, Alias, NCIS, Without a Trace, as well as American Dad and Curb Your Enthusiasm. From 2012 to 2018, he served as the creator, executive producer, and showrunner of the hit TNT show The Last Ship. And most recently, he was the showrunner, head writer, and executive producer of Halo, based on the legendary Xbox game by the same name. Now, Stephen and I really had a fantastic conversation about his journey through Hollywood, being able to work with some legends at the beginning of his career and how that affected the rest of his career, the ups, the downs, everything that went along with his journey in the film business. And of course, I ask him how he got involved with the long gestating project Halo, how he became the showrunner, head writer, and what the experience was like working on such a large project show with so many fans that were waiting for it for years and so much more. So without any further ado, please enjoy my conversation with Stephen Kane. I'd like to welcome to the show Steve Kane. How are you doing, Steve?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for coming on the show, man. I'm excited to get in the weeds with you about your process and that new little show
Indie thing I've been working on.
Yeah. A little indie thing I think called Hey something.
Yeah, I'm sure something here. Something.
Wow, like look at that. Yes, nice. Yes, indie production, that's not bad for a maquette.
No, you do a little of this with some fake background.
Is that 3D printed? That's nice.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So, Steve, you've had a varied career. Let's go back to the beginning, man. How did you get started and why did you get started in this insanity?
Well, it's funny. I'm from New Jersey and Southern New Jersey suburbs. And I think like most kids, you know, who get into movies, the love affair starts early, right? So I just loved going to the movies as a kid. I would go to parents would just drop me off at the mall and I would just go and see any movie that was playing. I would come in the middle of the movie and then stay for the changeover and watch the beginning of it. You know, I'd watch them over and over again. And I, you know, I had my Cinema Paradiso moments where I just look at the light coming through the window and think, how is that magic happening? And what does it mean when someone says written by, you know, it just didn't make sense to me. So, you know, and as I got older, I got more interested in it. I just started watching everything I could. VHSs were becoming a thing. I'm that old where they became a thing. Otherwise, I would go to the library and watch movies. And I watched like the Michael York Three Musketeers movie over and over again. And then I discovered The Godfather. I remember the first time I saw that Michael shooting the Salazzo in the restaurant. I was, you know, 13 or something, watching at home by myself, you know, after school. And I wish I could have that experience again for the first time seeing it, because that, you know, that's that moment. And jumping ahead, when I was in film school, I remember Walter Murch was going to come talk to us about film design, editing, sound. And I said, I want to ask him about that shooting scene, because there's this great elevated train sound that just fills the soundtrack, even though you never see the train. And the first thing he said when he came in was, I want to talk about a thing I call Michael's scream. And he said that train was the sound of Michael's soul screaming out, you know? So anyway, my love film started early. And then I had a great teacher in high school who was an English teacher, but also taught film appreciation. So, you know, we're reading James Joyce in third period and then watching La Strada or Ingmar Bergman's Shame in fifth period. So I, you know, I made little films with my friends, you know, on Super 8 cameras or Video 8 cameras. Then I went to college and just studied literature and French, but I knew I was always going to go into movies. So after college, I went to film school at USC. And, you know, I got 3 years just to live and breathe movies. And while I was there, I did like an internship at the Cannes Film Festival, met all these amazing people, met Robert Altman, you know. I think I said, nice to meet you. He said, get out of my way. But nonetheless, I met him.
It wasn't a deep conversation.
Wasn't a deep. We didn't talk cinema like I wanted to.
Exactly.
But that doesn't mean I'm not still borrowing from him every time, every chance I get.
Of course.
And then I met Oliver Stone. And I met his assistant. And I got a chance to be his intern during Natural Born Killers.
Wow.
Again, I think it was more impactful in my life than it was in his. But, you know, again, just as a kid, you grew up watching these movies and then you get to work with these guys and work around these people, you know. And then I got to just be on sets and studio lots and meet real working filmmakers and just got that thrill of being part of the process of filmmaking.
Then
I made a student film and, you know.
And the rest is history, as they say.
Yeah, yeah.
No, I have to ask you, man, what was it like being on set of Natural Born Killers, man? Like, you know, it's one of my favorite Stone films. And you know that we had him on the show and I had the pleasure of talking to him. But I remember I was in film school when Natural Born Killers would come out and I had the sound designer came to talk to the whole school.
Oh, cool.
And they showed us the first 10 minutes of Natural Born Killer.
Yeah.
Before anybody else had seen it. And we were just like, oh, but like the whole like the diner scene when the finger falls off and it's like the dropping. And I was just like, so what was it like, you know, being a, you know.
Well, I have to say, I was never on set. I was there during the prep, which is actually to me even more exciting because I drive around Woody Harrelson and Robert Downey Jr., you know, take him to the gun range. I learned how to use the weapons, met Dale Dye and those guys. But also, you know, he would be working on research. So he would send, you know, the intern out to get things. So literally, he was watching Clockwork Orange over and over again. He was reading certain books. I was like there just delivering those kinds of things and watching, trying to get a sense of how his mind worked as he built the thing. Mm-hmm. I was able to be around as they were rehearsing. You know, again, I'm like Rosencrantz and Guildenstern. I'm sort of on the edges of what's really happening. But, you know, now when I have interns and assistants and stuff, I always try to include them as much as I can because I know how exciting it is to learn.
Sure.
And to sort of take away some of the mystery of it and let them see how it's actually just people working very hard. And for all of Oliver's, you know, reputation as, you know, as a mad genius, he worked really hard. Everything was built, you know, from the ground up. And so it was fascinating. And, you know, collating the scripts and seeing the revisions coming in. Just amazing. I've been really fortunate because I've ended up working for some big name directors, first as an intern, then as a partner. You know, I made the student film at SC, which was sort of my homage to the Godfather. It was the Godfather's Driver, basically. It's like a 20-minute version. You know, imagine that little storyline about this young kid, low level hood, who thinks he can make his bones, you know, by and achieve his life dreams by whacking a rival mob boss for his bosses. And he gets everything he wants and it destroys it, you know, and it's all set at the symphony. So it's got this great music playing. And it's like all my influences were coming into one place. And then James Cameron saw the film, or his people did, and showed it to him. And he took me under his wing for a short time. We talked about making my short into a feature, but ended up doing something else altogether. In fact, while John Sayles was writing a script for him, he hired me and a friend of mine to write a movie for him. I was like 26 years old. He sent me to Moscow for a month to do research on the Russian mafia. And this was like the time when Yeltsin was in power and Russia was the wild, wild east. It was opening up to all kinds of crime. It was the formation of the oligarchs and that whole thing. And I was there for all of it, you know, in Moscow for a month. And while he was making Titanic, I was writing the movie. Titanic, sort of his little indie film, sort of took off as well. So the film never got made, but it was exciting. And then, you know, I wrote a bunch of more feature scripts that got bought but didn't get made, which is sort of par for the course. And as a person who actually likes to make films, it was very frustrating for me. So that's when a friend of mine said, you know, you should try TV because you write something and they actually put it on the air not that long. They shoot it not that long after you write it. Right. And so that's when I made my switch and haven't looked back. But again, even in that regard, I've worked with Michael Bay on a show. I'm working with Spielberg on a show. So all my heroes or the people whose work I just, you know, admire, I get to sort of be around them still, which is great. And now TV is so cinematic that I feel like I'm still making movies, you know?
So I have to ask you, what was it like working with James? I mean, that must have been James during Titanic.
Yeah. So I was 26. His one of his people saw my film, invited me into Lightstorm in Santa Monica, his company. I'm waiting. I have a friend waiting in the car. I think I'm just dropping off the VHS, but suddenly he comes out to talk to me and he's like, loved your movie. And I'm like, I like your movies too. You know? And, he said, what do you want to do next? They said, well, you know, in my mind, I had a 10-year plan when I was 15 or 16. You know, I'll go to film school, I'll make a film, and then I'll get to be a director, I guess. That's how it works, right? It wasn't quite that way. But here I was at the end of that 10 years, and I'm with Jim Cameron. And, you know, he said, tell you what, I'll give you an office here. And at the time, I was working with a friend of mine writing stuff. So he brought us both in, and we had an office on the second floor surrounded by Titanic stuff, like a scaled model of a ship, maybe 15 feet long, with little pen-like cameras that you can put into, you know, so it looks like you're actually in a doll's house in a room, and pictures of, you know, of the era and wardrobe. And so I was around as he was writing the script, as he was casting Leo DiCaprio, you know. Wow. It was amazing. But as far as my interaction, you know, I pitched him stuff, and he was great about working with him, even working with Bay. Like these people, they really work well with writers. They respect what you're doing and they want to help you achieve that. So, you know, I didn't get a lot of Cameron's time, but what I got was valuable and supportive, and that's bold. Try that some more. That's a great idea. I mean, it was like being in a writer's room. You know, it didn't feel like I was talking to executives, or, you know, it was just filmmaker to filmmaker, but, you know, with this great disparity at the time, of course. And ended up working on it for a year. I went to Russia. I learned some Russian. Again, these things happen. The film doesn't get made, but valuable experience. And, you know, his watching his cuts, watching his work, having studied his work and then being around him, I took him with me, just like I took a little bit of Oliver Stone with me. I take these mentors and these lessons with me as I do my own work. So, you know, you'd be amazed, or maybe you wouldn't be, when you're on the set of Halo or Last Ship or anything I've done, you know, the directors come in and you're like, you know what, there's this great shot that Kubrick did, or this really cool shot that so-and-so does. Let's copy that. Let's find our own way. So, you know, it's an ongoing process of learning and being inspired. And, you know, I just still get such a kick out of it. It's a thrill.
I mean, you have probably one of the most interesting beginning stories of like, oh yes, I was hanging out with Stone and I was interning on this and working with Spielberg and working. That's a pretty amazing, that's a great start to a career. And a blessing.
I don't think I understood it at the time, you know, because
you're probably like, oh, this happens to everybody, right? Everyone.
Well, yeah. Does this. I mean, I remember being in someone's office and thinking, you got a nice office, not really realizing I was talking to the head of the studio. You know, like I sort of just thought this is how it's supposed to be. And then I hit obviously rough patches and patches where you can't get arrested, you know. But I think, you know, people, I get all kinds of younger people now asking for advice, and I'm just like, just don't give up, you know, and always stay enthusiastic and then knock you down, just get up again and keep trying. And so, yeah, I mean, it's not, it isn't like I've gone from success to success, but these are the highlights of things that I experienced, you know, so.
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show.
As I said, when younger people come in, if I can give them a chance to have any kind of eye into what's going on, you know, at the higher levels and inspire them, that's, you know, paying it forward.
Now, what was the biggest lesson you took away from working with all of these giants in the business? It was like, was there that one thing that you're like, this is the common thing I see with all of these great filmmakers?
Yeah. You know, it's actually a lesson I keep trying to teach myself because I'm naturally very affable, collaborative person. And I think it's worked well for me, but it's also, it means I have to seduce and convince sometimes 1,000 people of the vision that I'm going for. And of course, you have to always compromise and you have to work together. And I'm not saying those guys don't do that, but what I was impressed with was their level of self-confidence that at least whatever their demons might be, that everyone has their secrets, but whatever they have going on the inside, they evinced a sort of confidence of this is the direction we're going to go. And you need that. You need to be a leader with a plan because and have confidence and believe in yourself, even when things don't go your way. So even when you fail, don't turn around and destroy yourself over it. Somehow find a way to learn from it, improve yourself, but keep your ego and your strength of confidence in yourself that you know, there's a reason why you're doing this. And so, you know, those are sort of examples. Usually they could, you know, you hear about egos and sort of larger than life personalities, but I think to do the stuff they do, to be bold like that, you know, it was one moment I saw or two moments. I saw Cameron again. I didn't get a lot of time with him, but, where I saw some vulnerability when he first finished the first draft of Titanic, he had this scriptment, this like 85 page.
His famous scriptment.
Yeah. He finally finished the script. You know, he had so much on his plate because he was already planning on shooting it. So the script was just like getting it off his chest. And he says, he walks by and he goes, well, it's done. You know, like, I don't know if it's any good kind of thing. And, you know, he was struggling with it. And, you know, it's nice to see that kind of human side. But at the same time, he put his career and his own money on the line to make that film because he believed in it. And he got, you know, hundreds of people to go along with it and to finance it and to make that come true. And it could have fallen on his face. Instead, you have this 3-hour movie that kids are coming and watching 3-4 times, you know. And I think it takes that sort of conviction, that strength of conviction. Obviously, you have to back it up with talent and back it up with the hard work it takes. Just having all ego and no talent doesn't get you very far. But I think the lesson I learned from the biggest players out there is that if you don't believe it and you don't show you believe it, no one else will. And the bigger you dream, the more you have to be confident that that dream is going to work because you're asking people to risk their own time and money and reputations to follow you. You know, so I try to tap into some of that and not lose who I am and not be brusque or rude to people, but also recognize that like sometimes you have to fake it till you make it too. Even if you're not sure it's going to work, you got to go forward and, you know, find that balance between healthy ego, being a dick, being wrong, you know. And so, yeah, I think those guys, they showed what having vision is, you know, in film school. Milos Forman came to one of our classes because Ivan Pasar, the great director who was very close with Milos back in Czechoslovakia in the '60s, they made films together. He taught a class and he brought in Barbe Schroeder, Milos Forman, Dustin Hoffman, Bogdanovich, just a lot of great people. And again, it was one of those things where I wanted to ask Milos Forman about the scene where they start the Requiem and they cut to Costanzi driving back in the coach, racing back to him. That's the first thing he brought up, which I was so psyched about. But we're watching it on like a DVD player or something. And all of a sudden he goes, stop. And the whole room, you know, stops. And I'm like, that's a director right there. He controls the room, you know. And it's a weird thing because even writing, it's personal at first, but then it's not personal. Now everyone's involved in it. And if you don't stick to your guns and believe in it, no one else will. So I got inspiration from those guys.
That's a great answer to that question, my friend. That's a very good answer. Now, So you decided to go into television because, you know, television, you get stuff done quicker, quicker.
Yeah.
And as the old adage says, the money's in television. So
the work is
the closest to a business you have. You're actually
a middle class existence, right? You can get a job, you can go to work, you can, you know.
Right. And as opposed to the filmmaker that makes one movie every 2 or 3 years.
If you're lucky, right?
If you're lucky.
Otherwise, you're having lots of meetings to take meetings about meetings. And you're like, literally like, oh, I'm very excited. Congratulations. That was a good meeting, you know?
Yeah, so, yeah. Exactly.
TV was definitely, you know, where it was at when I started.
So when you got your first job as a staff writer coming into a room, what was that day like for you? Like, I mean, you had already been writing, you'd been obviously hanging around with some reputable people. So you weren't a complete noob, but still walking into a room, it's like the first day of class. Like, you know, who I don't know these people. Who am I going to be friends with? Who do I have to look out for? What's the room? Is the teacher cool or is he not? He was cool when he hired me.
Right.
But it's kind of like that football coach is really sweet when he's recruiting you, but the second you get on the field, he destroys you. How was it for you on that day?
Well, that's a really good question, because actually everything I just told you about finding a healthy ego and sticking to your guns goes out the window when you're a staff writer on a TV show. You realize your job is to make the boss happy, to tell their story with them, to contribute, but to recognize your place. And coming out of independent film, coming out of, you know, features, I was ready to just be like, this is what we should do, blah, blah, blah. And Joel Wyman, who's a great writer and showrunner, he was giving my first job on a show called Keen Eddie. It was a very short-lived show, which I think just got a bad time slot, frankly. And it was set American Cop in London, very stylish, very fun. And, you know, I had just had a lot of enthusiasm. And so I was pitching. And at one point he said, you know, we don't all swim in Lake Keene. And I was like, oof. Come on in. The water's warm, you know.
Oh, but that's rough.
It was humbling, but we ended up becoming really close afterwards. But it was a good lesson. I think that the great thing about TV, if you're lucky and you can start at the bottom and work your way up, you actually learn the politics of a writer's room, learn how to be a contributor who doesn't, you know, gum up the works. A friend of mine told me about a metaphor that people have used. When you're in a writer's room, you're all pushing the rock up the hill, the same rock. And you either are pushing it, or you're watching it go up the hill, but you just don't want to be the guy who sits on the rock, you know? And I said, my question, of course, was, does it have to be a rock? That's the person who sits on the rock, right? So you learn to constantly adapt and adjust to what the showrunner is thinking. For him or her, they have a story they want to tell. You're trying to pitch to them something to make their story work. Sometimes it's a brand new idea that makes them think differently and they're just totally into it. And sometimes they're like, no, I want to go this direction. And so you learn how to be a civilized human being in a writer's room by being that kid who gets told to be quiet for a second and know your place and then work your way up and build trust. And so I learned how to be a showrunner by working on those early shows, especially when I got onto The Closer, where the showrunner, James Duff, and the producer director, Michael Robin, were such classy people, so collaborative, but at the same time, they, you know, it was their show. So you learned how to write their show and how to produce their show. And they also let you go onto set. So you can, you know, you're involved in casting and locations and wardrobe and props and, you know, working with the director. So I had a lot of experience in filmmaking that other writers don't, but every writer gets a great experience if you can get on a show that actually teaches you how to run a show. So by the time I got my first chance to pitch a show that I was going to run, I had all this experience in the politics of the writer's room, in how post-production works, how production works. And so I was extremely prepared for that. And again, having been at the lowest part, I know now how it feels. It helps me have more empathy for the younger writers on my staff. And I really believe firmly in promoting from within and giving people a chance. I've had several assistants become writers, become producers, you know, go off to do their own shows. And that makes me really happy and proud.
Now, can you discuss a little bit of what those unspoken rules inside of a writer's room? You mentioned the politics of the room. I love talking about the politics of the room because it's not something they teach you at school. It is it is something that you learn either the easy way or the hard way when you're in the room. So are there any kind of unspoken rules or advice you can give for writers, young writers, that if they find themselves, even if they're a writer's assistant in the room, whoever's in the room, what to do and what not to do?
Yeah, I mean, part of it's just probably like high school, how to get along. But, you know, one of the things I was taught early on is it never has to be anything. The story doesn't ever have to be what you want it to be. There are many ways to skin a cat. Even if you don't like the idea, you can make it work if you can do something to make it work, right? So to be the person in the room who gets locked on and fixated on one way of going can get you into trouble, because now you're not being flexible. You're not being part of the group. You're not helping. You're just being the person who shoots things down. There's that saying in improv, yes, and, you know, so it's that idea of, okay, that, and what if we do this, and that can make that work. And maybe you're solving six problems at the same time. You're not focusing on the problems. You're focusing on the story. Other ones are, you know, don't pitch the problem, pitch the solution, which actually I think works in lots of businesses. But, you know, you can say like, I don't like the way the story's going. I don't like that it's too easy the way he finds this and that. Okay, well, great. Thank you for your criticism. Any ideas? So you try to say, you know, I'm struggling with this moment, and here's how I'm thinking that we can make it work. Or admit, I don't have a solution for this, but this is bugging me. I'd like to maybe ask if we could talk about it for a couple of seconds. And just, you know, being respectful, catching the mood of the showrunner who's got, you know, a million things happening at the same time. You know, I know from my point of view, you keep leaving the room to be told, we just lost the actor. The set just burned down. You know, they're shutting it. You know, whatever it is, you come back into the writer's
room. There's a pandemic.
Exactly. You don't want to come back into the room and have some guy going, yeah, I don't like the story. You know, you're like, no, tell me how to freaking fix it if you got a problem. Otherwise, this is the way we're going.
Act two is horrible. I don't even, this is horrible. It's horrible. Well,
yeah.
And?
Exactly. And, you know, like any skill, when you first do it, you're very methodical and deliberate about it, and then it becomes second nature. So at this point, you know, I can pitch a scene that is probably doing nine things at once, but I'm not elaborating on what those nine things are. But when I have younger writers, I try to explain to them that this allows us to push the story forward, to get back to this character, to solve that plot hole, to give exposition here. Now let's bury the exposition. So there's a lot of skills that you can learn if you're open to learning them. And again, you could be the greatest writer in the world. You can still learn a lot from being in the writer's room. And you can also recognize that production needs will change your story in a heartbeat. You know, literally on Halo, we lost an actor the day before shooting a big episode. It was an actor who not only was important to that episode, but who had been established the previous episode as being important. And I didn't have to think about what to do. I had all this experience behind me. I mean, I thought about it, but I didn't have to curl up in a ball and die. I quickly rewrote 35% of the script and brought in a character who had smaller part and made them bigger. And I think actually the script ended up being better as a result. But I think that's the thing is, if you're a newer writer, you might just collapse like, oh, I guess we can't shoot. I guess we got to shut down. Like the show must go on. Right.
No.
I think if you keep your eyes open and you just watch the people with more experience do their job, you learn from it, you know, and then pretty soon, like I used to be on sets early where we'd shoot the whole scene. The director would turn to me and look at me and I'd be like, yeah, looks good. Yeah, sure. You know, and for the most part it did. And then we'd walk away and I'd say things like, gee, I wonder if we should have done X, Y, Z or this and that. And the director would look at me and be like, why didn't you tell me? I'm like, well, I don't know. I didn't want to, you know, get in the way. You know, I was so nervous about like being obtrusive. And so I had to learn how to, you know, stand up early and make these notes. But that's what you get from experience. Cause then you get to the place where you have confidence in yourself and you go, you know, guys, I think we should do another take and here's why.
Right.
And that takes, you know, some people come with lots of arrogance and confidence early. Some have to develop it with experience. But I think a lot of people now sell shows off the bat and they have no experience working in TV and they become a showrunner. And I think they're better served if they've had more experience with the politics of the room, with the way
politics of the studio, politics,
yeah,
of notes and
exactly
and everything, all of it.
Exactly. And to be that showrunner, you do have to be, as I was saying about those big directors I worked for, you have to be 100% confident in what you're doing. You have to be a cheerleader for your show. You have to be able to get people to go, that's the way we're going to go. On The Last Ship, which was a huge Navy show, I had, you know, Michael Bay was my partner. He had a lot of experience being, you know, working with the Navy and stuff, but he wasn't involved on a day-to-day basis after the first season. And so
we'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show.
There were times when I needed to get the Navy to give me the entire, you know, Marine
so you actually
squad.
Had the, you actually had the Navy working with
we
you.
We shot on a ship for 2-3 weeks every season, all the exterior stuff. We had Navy people in the writer's room sometimes. We had them on call if I needed a Navy subject matter expert on any subject, Navy SEAL, a flyer, a submarine or anything, I could call them up and get their help. And we got assets from them, you know, and they were very nervous because they said, you know, this is Hollywood. We don't want you guys to show us in a negative light because why are we going to bother giving you any support?
Of course, of course.
And I said to them and they didn't trust me whatsoever, rightly so, it's Hollywood. And I said to them, guys, look, this is not going to be a commercial for the Navy, but if you let me do my job, it'll be the best commercial for you guys ever because we're going to show you guys, we're going to test all your values. The honor, courage, and commitment, the way you guys work. We're going to forge the strongest steel in fire. It's going to come out even stronger. We're going to test those values, right? So we're not going to make you guys perfect, but we're going to come out on top. And once they saw that that's what the show was doing, because it was set during a global pandemic and it was, you know, these guys trying to,
about.
Yeah, but they were trying to be heroes, but they're also human beings. And by the third or fourth season, you know, even the second season, they were like, what else can we give you? But I'd have to walk into the room and convince the, you know, Marine Commandant that I need to get access to a beach landing. I want to do Saving Private Ryan on TV at the end of my series. And I want to shoot a, you know, Marine storming the beaches at Camp Pendleton in an exercise, you know. And so they gave us full access. We showed that up there with 12 cameras and drones and GoPros, filmed an entire beach landing, and then went back there 6 months later with our actors when I was directing it. And they still brought in, you know, hovercrafts and stuff for us. And we shot this amazing sequence that, you know, it looks like a $100 million movie, you know, just because of the stuff we had. But again, that took being able to look them in the eyes with confidence and say, this is going to be great. This is going to be really great.
And they have to buy it. And they have to buy it.
Yeah, yeah. So it's, you know, but again, that confidence doesn't come from just blind arrogance. It comes from, you know, having done the homework, you know. But you still have to present it in a way that makes them feel confident.
So I was going to ask you about The Last Ship because it was a pretty awesome show, man. And it was, it was so big for television. It's a fairly large looking show. And now I know why, because I didn't like, there's no way a TNT show is going to, I mean, I get Top Gun's going to get it. I get that.
Right.
Michael Bay is going to get it for his movie. That I get. I didn't think that. I thought it was, you know, oh, they might get a decommissioned ship. I didn't know the Navy was actively working with you. So that explains a lot. But so January 2020, there hits and you're going, oh God, because you just spent 4 years prior or a couple years, I think when it ended, what, in 2018?
Ended in like end of 17, beginning of 18. Yeah.
Something and like then, that. So then you had 2 years.
Yeah.
Right. So for a 5-year run, and then you stayed in that 5-year run in the mind of a pandemic. So when the pandemic actually hit, what was your reaction internally? Like, cause you knew things about pandemics that most people walk in the streets didn't, because you had to do the research to write all the shows and so on. So what was that like for you just as a, am I going to get up today?
yeah. Well, first of all, the Last Ship, you should know, it started with Michael Wright, who ran TNT at the time, who's a brilliant programmer and brilliant studio network head. And he talked to Michael Bay and had this book called The Last Ship. It said, this would be a great Michael Bay show. We want to pair it with Spielberg's Falling Skies and Sunday night, you know, big movie night kind of thing. And Bay's people found a writer, Hank Steinberg, who I grew up with, who came to me and said, this is your cup of tea, will you come on board? And I said, okay, but the book is about a nuclear holocaust, which is obviously still timely, but it felt very dated. It was very 80s, you know?
Right.
And I said, you know, what scares me more is pandemics. And I said, can I change it? And he said, sure. So he, you know, came up with this whole thing and I cold called a bunch of virologists who all said, this is our worst nightmare. And we started talking. Then we built this virus And we talked about the effects on society as well. You know, I don't think I got some of the craziness that came out of the pandemic in our second or third season. But
was there a scene of toilet paper hoarding? Did you?
There was no hoarding of toilet paper because we were with the Navy ship at the
time.
That's
true. So, that's true.
But they did loot a defunct cruise ship with a bunch of dead people on it. And they had to get, you know, get all the food they can get and, you know, get out. So, so I was very aware of pandemics and I had a lot of conversations. So I remember being on the set in Hungary. We were in some Boy Scout camp shooting a sequence. And people are talking about this virus. They said, you know, I heard it's in Italy. It might come to Austria. Do you think it's going to come here? And I said, guys, we're going home soon. They said, what do you mean? I said, it's going to be here. And what I'm reading about, it's serious. And sure enough, 2 weeks later, we took our 2 week hiatus, which lasted 6 months. And I called home. I said, I'm coming home. And this is going to sound weird, but you should go out and buy toilet paper, staples,
water.
Why toilet paper? Because people are going to think that they're going to run out and they're going to start to hoard it. So you might as well do it too. You know, you can't fight it. And so I came home and hunkered down for 6 months and talked to my virologist friends who told me, you know, there's going to be an mRNA vaccine, you know, in 6 months. It's going to be this and this and that. And I sort of followed what they were talking about. The one thing that I thought would be worse, but seems to have crept up over the last, you know, 6-8 months is the supply chain stuff. I thought it would have been more instantaneous, but you know, not a lot of people didn't get sick or didn't take the shots and didn't stop working. But you know, the idea that the supply chain is still messed up, it's a natural recurrence. But what's fascinating is the way your mind shifts to a new reality during a pandemic. We obviously had a much worse pandemic in the show, so we shifted people's minds more. But it's I was sad to be right about that.
Oh, good Lord.
Yeah. But even now I watched the first episode of Halo and I watched it at Austin at the film festival and actually made me cry because it reminded me of Ukraine. Obviously this is fiction. Sure. This is not as serious as Ukraine, but people being slaughtered by an enemy that they can't control. Like suddenly I started
for
to
no
like,
reason.
See residences, yeah. You know? Yeah. And I started kind of, you know, thinking about as you get older, I think these things, they don't feel like make believe anymore. They feel like, you know, possibilities of life and it's frightening.
You start thinking about your kids and you start thinking about, you know, like the next generation and you're like, there's a shift as you get older where you stop thinking about yourself only because you now you're like, okay, I'm past my 20s now, you know?
Yeah.
You know, and you just know a little bit more because you just walk the earth a little bit like Kane.
Yes.
Kung Fu. You've walked the earth a bit more and you're like, wait a minute, how is what I'm doing now going to affect my kids? And then you get my grandkids. And that's when it starts. So yeah, you start thinking about things and what's going on now is just horrific. And, you know, I don't want to get into that because that's not the show, but,
Speaking of my kids, after we had the LA premiere of Halo, we showed two episodes and my 16-year-old and my 18-year-old were there. And afterwards, they both said to me, good job, Dad. That was really cool. So when your kids think you're cool.
That's the better than an Oscar.
Yeah. But then I did a dumb dance. They're like, nope, never mind. Not cool. Not cool.
Not that cool at all.
Yeah, not cool at all.
I don't think you could. I mean, I always wonder, like, does Brad Pitt's kids think he's cool?
Right.
Like, you know, these cool icons, do they think their kids think they're cool? And they're like, no, they're just nerds.
Yeah.
Now, is there something that you wish you were told at the beginning of your career that if you could go back in time and go, there's this one thing that I wish I would have told myself or I wish someone would have told me?
Yeah, I think I've told this to younger people. I was so single-minded and fixated on making it in the business and being a director and being a writer and filmmaker like the ones I admired. And I was stubborn about that. So a couple of things as a result, I stopped enjoying the day-to-day. Imagine being in your 20s and not just realizing I'm in my 20s. This is awesome. You know, nothing hurts.
Oh my God. I wasted my 20s. I heard Steve Harvey say something which was so brilliant. He's like, you waste your 20s and you make so many mistakes in your 20s that you end up your 30s, you end up fixing all the mistakes you made in the 20s.
Yeah.
But if you would have, and then, the 40s, you start doing the things that you should have been doing in your 30s.
Right.
But because of your 20s, you screwed up. I was like, that's fairly brilliant.
I remember being 25, turning 25, and being depressed with my, and saying, right, Orson Welles made Citizen Kane at 25.
Oh, we all do.
You know what I mean?
God. Oh, no.
Such a cliche, yeah, right? And so
Spielberg at 27 did Jaws. Oh yeah, we all do it.
Right,
and as that,
right,
and isn't it so stupid? We all do it. All filmmakers do it. We, yeah, all click the times. Like,
yeah,
well, I only got two more years before 27, so I better hurry up and, yeah, make Jaws.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. But so I look back and I go, but you know what? Look at all the fun things you can tell. Like working for Oliver Stone was, I mean, I have some great stories, right? All these experiences, appreciating them now and saying, I wish I actually enjoyed them more when I was going through them. The other thing is, as I said, about, yep, being flexible was, you know, for a while, if I wasn't making feature films that I was writing, directing, I wasn't doing anything else. And then as reality hits, you know, I literally found myself, because I had a young family, I was making industrial videos for cancer hospitals and engineering schools at USC, and thinking, am I going to be the, you know, James Cameron of
industrials
fundraiser dinner videos, you know? But you know what? As a result, I actually learned, that's where I met my first virologist and I got interested in that stuff. So I learned stuff that I brought to my writing, but also going to TV. I thought I'd never do TV when I was going to be a young filmmaker.
TV was taboo. I mean, let's be honest. Right, like when we were coming up, TV, yeah, was like, you know, TV's like, you go there if you got nothing else to do.
Right.
Where now,
but my
everybody
point is if
wants
you,
to be.
Exactly. But if you're flexible to things, you find yourself getting alternate routes to the same place. So,
yeah,
you know, I wanted to direct. I made this film. I was going to be a director. And then I was getting work as a writer, which was, again, how great is that? But at the time I thought, but I'm a director too, you know? And so my directing was kind of put on hold. And so I didn't get my DGA card till my mid 40s, you know? And I was like, I can't believe I thought I'd be a director. And I'm just a writer of these giant shows. And, but then when I got to be a showrunner and I got to be really, you know, in charge of the whole process, the directors are working with me, everyone, and I'm able to tell, because I feel like filmmaking is, you know, writing is the most important part of it. Without that, you don't have anything to work with. But it's if it just lives on the page, it's not really a thing. It's like an opera. It's got the music, it's got the sound, it's got everything, you know. And so being a showrunner and doing these shows allows you to be the filmmaker in a very full way. And then I got to hire myself as a director anyway, eventually, you know, on The Last Ship. So, and a little bit on Halo. So, you know, it's, I think I tell younger people, don't sweat it. Don't take yourself too seriously. Enjoy what you're doing now. Never lose focus on what you want to do, but recognize that there's many ways to get there, and go with the flow, go with follow your bliss. All those cliches are all true. Go with what makes you happy and you're enjoying it. And I still get a thrill walking onto a set, you know,
it's always.
If that thrill goes away, then I'm going to quit, because everything else is so hard about the business that I only do all that to get back on the set. So if the set's not fun, then I'm going to do something else, you know?
You know, and as a filmmaker, you work, like we said earlier, three years to be on set for, if you're lucky, 45 days. And that's a hell of a nice budget. If you're in a studio, it's 60 or 90 days.
Right.
But you spend most of your life chasing the ability to be on set.
Yeah.
And television's a little different. And television, you could be on set all the time. And I think that's a really, right, much nicer place to be. I do like that, yeah, you said that in your 20s, nothing hurt. People listening who are in their 20s, enjoy it.
Yeah.
It will end.
Yes.
Go to Taco Bell right now at 3 o'clock in the morning, eat whatever you want.
Yeah. When we were in Hungary filming, I was like, can I get a salad? And my script coordinator, who was like 29, was eating like goulash and pork this and rooster testicle. And I'm like,
beer.
Do you do that? Yeah. I'm like, no, I have to get up in the morning. I got to, you know, give me some seltzer water, you know?
Oh, now it's the two old fogies talking now about,
yeah, exactly,
like,
Sorry,
my sciatica. Oh.
Listen, not to betray confidences, but I did have to buy orthotics for Oliver Stone for his shoes. So,
hey,
listen.
That is some
That's
of the
key
most
to directing.
Key to directing and a Steadicam operator. Good shoes.
Right. Right.
Good shoes. I talked to the guy who created the Steadicam once. I was taking a class up in Maine years ago, and he was teaching the class. And I go, what's the best advice you could give a Steadicam operator? He's like, good shoes. I was like, And as you're on set, you realize, I mean, I directed on set with Bad Shoes.
Yeah.
Ooh, because you're 12 hours sometimes.
Yeah, easily.
12 hours.
Camera operators are my heroes on set.
Yes.
I've seen, you know, it's like Ginger Rogers. They do it backwards and in heels. They're running backwards, being shot at blanks and stuff.
Oh,
they're catching the shot. And the great ones, they know how to tell the story with the camera. They're great partners on the set. I mean, I just love the whole process.
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show. So let's get to that little independent film thing that you just did, Halo. There has been it's beautiful, beautiful maquette. Halo has been in development for since basically the damn game came out. There's so many different, you know, directors and projects. It's going to be a feature. It's not going to be a feature. It's this or that. And it's come and gone so much. So when I gave up on it, I truly it's going to be in production hell or development hell forever. Right. So then when I saw the news that you were doing it, I was like, I still don't believe it until I see a trailer. Because I've been burned before.
Sure.
So how did you get Halo? Like, that's a pretty big, you know, feather in the cap, man. Because everybody wanted to do Halo. Some of the biggest filmmakers in the business wanted to do Halo. So how did you come to, how did Halo get dropped into your lap, sir?
Well, it kind of did, actually. I mean, I had been following the project's development, like everybody else, hearing about it. And actually some friends of mine were writing scripts for it at one point when I was doing The Last Ship, and I was kind of jealous of that, but I was busy. And The Last Ship had ended and I was developing and working on my own stuff. And my manager, my agent called and said, look, they're making the show. The guy who they were working with does not want to continue, does not want to go to Hungary to make the show. And, you know, he's been working on stuff for a while, but there's still a lot of room for you to come in and do something. Would you be interested? It might mean going away for a few months to Hungary. I didn't realize it would be 2 years.
Yeah, I was about to say, you don't go for a few months for production in Hungary.
Right. So I was like, okay. I didn't know what I was getting into. And, but I walked into a situation where you could feel there was a lot of history in terms of the development process. And I had to put that all out of my head and say, this is the show that I think we should make. What you have here, you have a lot of great stuff. Kyle Killen and his team did some really good stuff, which I kept a lot of. He's a great guy. We had a good partnership for the time we overlapped. But I said, look, to make this thing work, both story-wise and production-wise, these are my opinions. But again, I had to show, you know, everyone that this is the way to go. And it was hard because there's a lot of money at stake, a lot of people involved, a lot of pressure, and everyone really wanted this to be great, especially of course, the people at 343 whose baby Halo is. They wanted to make sure they didn't disappoint the loyal fan base, that they also expanded their fan base. I felt for all of them that it was an impossible situation.
And I have to stop for a second. How did you deal with the pressure of dealing with such a huge character like Master Chief, the franchise, the budget? I don't even know what the budget is, but I know it was fairly, fairly disgusting. So that pressure on a showrunner, how can you be creative in that scenario? I mean, I know you're built for that. I mean, the last ship was no joke either.
Right. It
was a big show, you know, but this is we're at a whole other level here. So how did you even function, man? Seriously.
You know, I compartmentalized. My body did a lot of the reacting for me, where my mind ignored it. So suddenly I'm like, what is this rash? You know, things like that. You know, like, why haven't I eaten anything? No, honestly, I was alone a lot and hungry too. So I was kind of homesick. It was emotionally and psychically difficult. But I think what I always focus on, no matter if the show is, you know, $10,000 or $10 million or whatever, it's still about how do I tell the story? So, you know, making a big show, you just have a bigger budget to play with, right? So if you're a family of four with a fixed income and you have to make sure you can have food and gas for your car, that's what you do. If you're now a billionaire and now you've got 17 houses, you have to manage, it's just bigger problems, right? But it's the same issue of like, okay, we have X number of days. What you've written is going to take 5 extra days. We can't do that. Can you rewrite it and make it shootable? That happens even when you're doing a $3 million show or a $1 million show. So you focus on the stuff you can control, which is the filmmaking process. You try not to take on everyone else's stress as your own. It's hard because I'm an empathetic person and I feel the stress and I know they're counting on me. So I honestly don't know. I think I just did a lot of compartmentalizing, focusing on what I'm doing, what the work is for today. And also, again, it goes back to having that joy, because like when you walk onto the set, instead of looking at the hundreds of people on the set and the all the equipment and, oh my God, is it going to rain? I think, holy cow, we thought of something that now we're shooting it. Now a man is jumping off of a mountaintop with a hook, landing on a styrofoam purple thing that's going to eventually be a spaceship. You know what I mean? Like, so you focus on the exciting stuff, but I'm not gonna lie to you. It was balancing the desires of 13 different partners, all of them there before I got there, vested in this show. You know, Last Ship, the first season, was also stressful because it was a big swing for TNT, Michael Bay show, blah, blah, blah. Everyone was watching everything we did. Navy was on our butt, making sure we were not making them look bad. So it was similar in that regard. That the bigger the arena you play in, the more pressure you're going to get. But if you look at it the same way you look at making something small, in terms of this is what I can control, this is the creative, you know, you just you can get through it. But I remember at one point saying to the people at Showtime about the budget, they had given us a number, and we were over that number, and they said, and I said, well, just give me a number. And they go, we did give you the number. I said, oh, you were serious about that number. Okay. All right. Well, we'll figure it out. You know, and we cut the budget, you know, it's just about, like, honestly, I want to go from here to there. How am I going to get there? And everything else is just an obstacle to getting there. But, you know, you're not alone. You have tons of people supporting you. You've got a crew, which is amazing. You got producers who want to make this thing work. No one wants to shortchange the show. So, you know, it's my job. You know, there was one sequence in an upcoming episode where half the show is supposed to be shot in snow.
Oh, that's
outdoor,
fine. Oh,
that's outdoors fine. In snow, driving these warthogs, having conversations. Nothing about it made sense practically. And frankly, the story wasn't that exciting to me anyway. So I said, you know, why don't we save $10 million right now and we'll shoot that entire sequence, that whole storyline. I'll change the storyline. Same principle idea. We'll put it all on our sets. We'll focus on the characters. We'll use this as an opportunity for these characters to get to know these characters and really enrich and deepen the sort of the emotional stakes. And we don't have to be outside. We don't have to look for snow. And literally, we'll save millions of dollars. And so that's the kind of decision-making process that happens in every show. You know, you decide, like, well, if we shoot it outside, you know, on the Last Ship, I used to make these giant opening episodes, and we'd be $2 million over budget from the first day. And everyone's like, oh my gosh, we're out of control. And I'm like, guys, don't worry, because the fourth episode, I've already planned it. We're going to be in the ship the entire time at night. Literally no visual effects, no guest cast, no extra sets. We'll shoot it in 9 days instead of 12 days. And we'll save $1 million in one episode. You know, of course, they didn't at first believe me. But once we did that a few times, they started recognizing, okay, at the end of the season, he's going to be net zero. And we actually ended up being on budget the entire time. So you have to think nimbly and be on your feet and just let the pressure excite you and not crush you. There are definitely times when I wanted it to crush me, but I think, or I was going to let it crush me, but I think you just got to keep your eye on the prize and just say, okay, I can't go left, we'll go right. I can't go up, we'll go down first, then we'll go up. And, you know, usually, like when I said, when you lose an actor the day before shooting, you pivot. And in the end, sometimes that makes it even better.
I found that it always, you know, it, at the moment, it's the worst thing that could possibly happen to you. If you lose a location, you lose an actor. Every time throughout my career, it always ends up being better. It always ends up doing something that you never in a million years thought of. That's so much better than what you had in mind. I've never lost something and just like it ruined it.
Yeah, I
never had that happen in any of my projects. So
all those cliches are true. Like you asked what the advice you give people. Again, that making lemonade out of lemons.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely.
It's a big one.
The COVID was a huge blow for the whole world. And it shut us down and it cost the studio a fortune. And they were such champs about it, making sure we stayed safe and bringing us back safely. And it was hard. We were in Hungary now, couldn't go home. Family couldn't visit me. Couldn't visit people at night. We had curfews. So I was literally in a van with a mask, going to work, going home. barely having any social interaction, but we pulled it off. But even so, the 6 months that we were shut down, I used those 6 months, we all did, to get visual effects, to get editing done, to re-examine the scripts and rewrite them. So we took a terrible situation and we spun it and made the most of it. And I think the show actually is better for it. Again, I would never trade that. I'd rather have no COVID, but
sure, of course.
If you take the bad things and let them crush you, then you get nothing out of those bad things. If you take the bad things and spin them around to something positive, then at least you've made lemonade.
Yeah, there's no question about it. I always find it that when I sat down with a script of mine with a first AD, a really seasoned first AD from, like, he's been doing, you know, work with Fincher and all these kind of crazy people. And he's sitting there and he's looking at it and he's like, does this have to be at night?
Yeah.
Why is this at dawn?
Right.
Why is this at dusk? You need, and those little tricks, mm-hmm. the budgetary things, because as a writer, you're just like, it's going to look so good at sunset.
Yeah.
Sure it will, but you've got 15 minutes.
Yeah, exactly.
Unless you're on The Mandalorian, then you have a sunset all day. But right. Unless you're
just from the screen.
Yeah. But other than that.
Yeah.
So those little tips that they don't teach you those right. things. That's just practical everyday stuff. So that's what you were saying. Like, let's take all the snow, like, you know, the rain. Why is it raining? Does it need to rain? Do we need to have rain? Right. That's right. going to add. Right. Oh, so much money to the budget.
On the last ship, we decided season four, we've never had any storms at sea. That's ridiculous. We're a ship at sea.
Yeah.
So we wrote the storm episode and we planned it 6 months in advance. We were looking for footage of storms to be able to use for CG. We were retrofitting the ship to make it be able to
water sets,
capable. Yeah. Water capable. And, you know, you plan for it, but you don't just go like rain. You have to go, okay, we're having a meeting today. We're talking about rain.
Rain 6 months you're right. from now.
And I think the other lesson for young writers is you can write anything you want when it's on spec. But
right.
when you, everything you write, some department head is highlighting it and they're going to try to get you what you want. So I've been on sets where they say, we're having a tough time getting sharks. I was like, what's that? They said, yeah, you said that sharks. I said, oh no, I was just writing that. It's fine. You don't need sharks. They're like, okay, cancel the shark wrangler, you know.
Or, cancel the shark wrangler.
Yeah. I told our visual effects guy in the last ship, I had written that the enemy, I wanted to show the enemy was badass and that as they were being fired at, they were like acrobatically diving out of the way. So I wrote Matrix style, meaning like ballet.
Bullet time.
Suddenly we're having bullet time conversations. And I'm like, I'm so sorry. I hope you didn't spend any money on this. You know, so even as a showrunner, I was doing that, making those mistakes. So the point is that everything you write has to have a reason. And you're better off not writing something, letting let's say the wardrobe department come to you and say, what were you thinking about for the scene? Or here's what I was thinking having read the scene. But if you write, she's in a purple muumuu, they're going to
go get a purple muumuu.
Yeah. And if you were kidding or you really weren't thinking, you're just making it look pretty on the page, then, you know, you're going to cause people a lot of work. So that's the thing is, especially when you're a young writer, you think no one cares about your stuff. But guess what? When you're on staff, even if you're the lowest person on staff, you write a script, it gets to the set, it's the Bible. Now, every department is going to make what you wrote come true, which is why you got to be appreciative of them. You got to be collaborative with them. You got to be right. smiling and thankful at them. And you have to respect them and their time because they're trying to make your dreams come true. You know, the guy pushing the dolly doesn't always have the same, you know, like, look at me on the screen. They're just pushing a dolly for the day. The good ones do. They take pride in it. They only take pride in it is if you welcome them into the process. So if you embrace your camera team, embrace your electricians and say, we're all going to make this amazing show together, then you get better work from them and happier people.
Right. And I think I'm going to get that. I'm going to get what you said on a t-shirt, a cancel the shark wrangler. I think that's that's a great crew t-shirt.
Cancel yeah. the shark wrangler. We actually had a cricket wrangler on the last ship at one point. And I actually was so lucky because I at the time, and still my son was obsessed with his lizards. I was always buying crickets for him.
Sure.
And I learned you don't want to buy the large crickets because they're the ones that make all the noise. If the medium and small don't croak or whatever the word is, they don't make that noise. So of course you're on the movie set, you don't want to have noise. So I said, no, they have to be medium crickets because the large ones make a lot of noise. I know this because my kid, you know, so those kinds, but we had a cricket wrangler and after we were done, she had to collect all 1,000 of them, make sure that they were all okay. And they all got their, you know, their per diem.
Exactly. So, they're per diem.
I think a few of them may have gotten, you know, didn't quite make it, you know.
A couple of.
Yeah.
I mean, no, of course, they all made it. No crickets were harmed in the making of your show, sir. None.
There were stunt crickets, so they were fine.
They were, they were stunt crickets, okay?
Yeah.
Made out of little styrofoam. It was amazing. Exactly. Hollywood magic. So was there a day, and I know the answer is yes, but I'm going to ask it anyway. Is there a day on Halo that the entire world came crashing down around you and you said, oh my God, what the hell am I doing? This entire thing is going to go down in smoke. I know we've already talked about the, losing the actor, but is there another moment?
Yeah.
And was it every day? We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show.
Well, yeah, I don't think we ever, I ever had an experience where I said the whole thing is going to come down crashing. There were times where I thought that's just too much to do right now, because what happened was by the time I came on board, the train was already speeding out of the station. So they were sort of building and looking for locations based on old material that I was going to be changing. So I had to keep giving them new drafts. Like the story that got out, you know, that I said glibly one day, I did 265 drafts, which I did. But that was because literally I would get to work on Monday and the producer would say, we need another draft for props or for locations to start their work. So I'd crank out another draft in 24 hours and get it just for that department, you know, and I'd say, it's not done yet. It's just enough. But I had to get every script ready at the same time. So I was working on one and then two and then three, four and then five and then nine and then seven. And then, you know, so I was constantly having to shift gears, remember where I was in the season and deliver, because production needed the lead time to be able to prep for whatever I was doing. So again, that's also where the COVID break helped a little bit, where we could do some planning. But so I think every day felt like you're being chased by an avalanche.
Great analogy. I love that.
But at the end, when you kind of get to the bottom, you kind of go poof, and it goes right by. You're like, it wasn't so bad, you know. But look, I'm still mixing shows as we speak, you know, and still doing score and visual effects as we speak. And again, if you take it, sorry, you know, the dog's barking.
It's all good.
Yeah. If you can take it day by day and just sort of say, I can only do what I can do. You know, I had some help here once in a while, a writer would come out, producer would come out and help me, but otherwise there was no writing staff. Once I got to Hungary. So it was literally like just a stack next to me of like, okay, now I have to deal with this. Now, oh, we lost this actor. Okay, let's get to, you know, work on that. So the risk for me was I had to show my ass a lot, right? I had to write drafts that weren't perfect, that weren't great, because I needed to get scripts out for production. So it's, you never want to show work that you don't feel is ready, but you had no choice. So what would happen was you'd do it and then you'd get like notes and criticisms and stuff. And go, I know, guys, there was just this temporary thing so I can get the art department going, or so I can get casting going, or, you know, like I would get calls, can you give me some audition sides for episode 8? I'm like, but I haven't written episode 8 yet, you know, so I have to write scenes for episode 8 just to give it to you, you know, that kind of stuff. So it was a lot, but again, it was so absurd that I just sort of had to laugh. But in the end, like I said, I had a really strong idea of what I wanted the show to be. And I try to stick to that every single day. And I think, you know, I'm really proud of the season. I think we stick the landing, it comes out, and we didn't get buried by the avalanche. But, you know, there were some hilarious things. We built giant sets that we ended up going, I don't think we're even going to use that now. You know, stuff like that. Lots of lessons learned, certainly ways to save money next season and other stuff like that. But any first year show is like that. The last ship was no different. It was, you know, craziness. How are we going to shoot on a ship? How are we going to do this? I mean, you know.
But it just sounds like you said the train left. So you were like thrown into a machine, a giant machine that was already moving and was going to keep going no matter what. You were just tossed into the gears and you're just trying to oil things up and try to keep things going. And no, guys, not east. We're going west. We got to move the whole ship over. And
The metaphor had was that it was like a train speeding with no tracks in front. So I had to keep throwing down the track
to
keep us from crashing. But yeah, your metaphor is perfect.
And you were the only writer in Hungary?
Yeah. So when I first took over, I grabbed two writers that I was close with from the last ship days and had 3 weeks just to sort of go, okay, well, how are we going to redo this? Because the scripts aren't lining up and the story, you know. And so we worked in LA for a few weeks. Then I went to Hungary. And then
it was just you.
And then it was just me. And then I would I would beg them, and I would get one of the writers. Katie would come out for a couple of weeks, and then we'd send her home. And then we brought in another writer for Mickey Fisher, great guy, for a few weeks, but then he wasn't going to be able to stay. And so, you know, a young woman came in, and I said, you know, she'll help us work on the Cortana stuff. And then, you know, it was a 2-week deal or whatever. So it was a lot of like piecemeal. It wasn't like I had a staff that was like, okay, you're covering episode one, you're covering episode two. It was, I think there was a misconception that, well, the show was, it's fine. It's going to be fine. It's already written. You're just going to manage it. But it turns out it wasn't already written, and it was a lot of story to tell and to make. So it was like, you know, you remodel your kitchen and go, well, now that the kitchen's so nice, the living room needs some work.
Looks horrible.
And now that I'm sitting here, what the frick is that on the wall? You know, so it became sort of a full on remodel teardown.
It was a tear. What originally was just a bathroom.
My predecessors, right?
It was just a bathroom, but then all of a sudden, like, well, if the bathroom looks so nice, the kitchen looks horrible now. Now the kitchen looks so nice. Yeah, I got to do the second bedroom. Like,
but that, by the way, none of this is to criticize any of the people who were working on it, because
it was just different.
The show had to get made, and honestly, it's such a tough show that you could sit there and ponder every decision until you're paralyzed.
Oh.
Or you can say, let's just make this show, and I think that. In the end, I learned a lot from the stuff that came before me. They learned a lot from the stuff that came before me. We ended up coming up with a story that everyone really liked and got behind. And what was great too was there were still moments where I could surprise myself, you know, where I would go, wait a minute, what if this happens at the end of this episode? That would change the entire story and give me more work to do later on. But like, there are some moments where I was still able to find surprises and joy and epiphanies and things like that. And they even come up now in post-production, but this is not to say that the show was like haphazard or rough and tumble. It was just the nature of making this kind of show. It was a battle from start to finish, but there was always the sense of what we wanted the show to be. It just was getting it there. It was, you know, at the scale was challenging. Oh
my God. I can't even imagine that the amount of people that are interested in making sure this is good, the history of the it's kind of like, you know, being given Jurassic Park and it's never been made before, and somebody wanted to make Jurassic Park and it's 1,000 different people trying, and it's been 10 years trying to turn 15 years trying to make it. I mean, what you've done is pretty gargantuan. It's a Titanic, no pun intended, event that you were able to put together.
And I'm hoping people look like it, because, you know, I know there's people who are diehards of the game who are going to say we veered too far away. Others are going to say we were slaves to it. Others are going to say something else. Like, you know,
it's always
and,
the case.
Our hearts were in the right place. I worked very closely with Microsoft. We tried our best to honor the ethos of the game and the feel of the game while telling a story that's cinematic, that, you know, is different, so you don't just watch the game on TV. And so we try to give rewards to the people who love the lore, and also people who don't know the game at all or the canon can also just enjoy it as a powerful story about humanity's quest to avoid being extinguished by an alien race, you know. So
and then of course your next show will be Metal Gear. So
the next one's going to be two people in a room. It's going to be Waiting for Godot, the series.
Dinner with Andre. It's my dinner with Andre.
Yes. But I'll call Michael Bay, and we'll see if we can make it. We can zhuzh it up a little bit.
Zhuzh it up a bit.
Yeah.
I have one last quick question. What do you look for in a writer in a room? Because I know a lot of writers who want to get in a room. What do you personally look for in a writer?
The first thing is, can I see myself spending a lot of time in a room with this person? Seriously, like, is this person going to be, you know, a fun person to be around, or at least not a bad person to be around? You don't always know that up front, but that's super important. You know, it's a little bit like, you know, getting a baseball team together or a basketball team together. You look for, like, is this person a good shooter? Is this person a good runner? Is whatever. And so some people might be like really quiet in the writer's room, which is not great, because the writer's room is where you want ideas to flow. But if there's one person who's quiet and just takes notes, it's not so bad, because not everyone can talk, right? But if that person is thoughtful and they have one note and it's great, or their scripts are phenomenal. There might be others whose writing isn't perfect or great, maybe takes a lot of rewriting, but they can be trained, they can learn, but they're fantastic in the room because they're always pitching ideas. Like my thing when I was coming up was I would go, what about this? And they'd say, no. I'm like, okay, how about this then? And they say, no. I'm like, okay, well, what about that? And then eventually I never gave up. So my sort of doggedness is what, you know, people could count on me to sort of always be trying. You know, so I think you look for a balance. You don't want everyone to be a big alpha. You don't want everyone to be sort of the meek one. Ultimately, though, when it comes down to writer for writer, you want someone who has a voice, has an opinion, has a life that's interesting. You want diversity. So you want to have people who come from different walks of life because that they bring that into the room. You know, it's amazing how you get different perspectives. You know, if you've got people from different socioeconomic, racial, sexual, anything backgrounds, it keeps you from getting into your bubble too much. You don't do it to pander. You don't do it to sort of be woke. You do it because you're trying to tell a full story. And so, you know, like you want a young person, you want a person with a young family, you want a person with kids in college, you want a person who's retired, a person who's lost, you know, you just want people who can bring their life to your show. And then who have a point of view and a passion for writing and for filmmaking. But yeah, I think ultimately, though, it's really about who do you want to be collaborative with? Who do you think you can work with on a day-to-day basis? And we'll, you know, we'll have your back, too. You know, the other thing that happens is sometimes you get people who their show didn't sell. So now they're working on your show and they don't really want to be there. And they're like,
they want your job.
Yeah. And they're on the phone with their agent and trying to sell the things while you're like waiting for a script. Like, I want the show to be as important to you as it is to me. I know it's impossible if it's not your show, but I want to feel that way. When I was on The Closer, I gave that show all my attention and, you know, really wanted to make it great because that's where I was spending my days. And, you know, I think that also you rise up faster that way too. Like I was talking to a young kid the other day who was wanted to make it, you know, he was interning and stuff. And I said, you know, if you just show the people you're working for that you are the hardest working person, the easiest person to get along with, they'll recognize that. If they're not jerks, they'll recognize that. They'll want to promote you. But if you walk in thinking I deserve better from the very get-go and this is beneath me, you won't, you know. I learned that the hard way because I did come out of being my own independent film guy and then suddenly I'm in staffs and I'm being told, you know, we don't all swim in Lake Kane. And once I changed my attitude, I rose really fast. And I had a showrunner. I went from executive story editor to co-executive producer in one season.
Wow.
And I've done the same thing for other writers I've had on my show. People start off as staff writers. By the end of the last shift, they were co-EPs because I could just see it in them. They were dedicated to the show. They were dedicated to working hard and to putting in the hours outside of work. You know, it's so I think I forget the question, but I think that's the answer.
Well, like the best advice I ever got is don't be a dick.
Don't be a dick. Yeah.
Best advice you could get is don't be a dick. Now I'm going to ask you a couple questions. I ask all of my guests. What advice would you give a filmmaker or screenwriter trying to break into the business today?
I would say, you know, there's no excuse these days for not making product that someone can look at, whether it's a script or a short or, you know, a play. I think that more and more people want to see people with their own unique voices and they can teach you the business side of things. They can surround you with people to help you. That's always been the case, but now I think with technology and the internet, it's even more so that you can make your own portfolio and your own world.
Right.
I think, you know, Steven Soderbergh, have you ever had him on yet?
Not yet. I'm trying. Yeah.
I've read a lot of his stuff and he's busy.
He's busy.
I met him briefly after I made an independent film online at the movie theater. He was so nice. But, he has a quote in one of his books, which I always think is a good formula for success. Talent plus perseverance equals luck.
Oh, so that's great.
That's literally if you gave up too soon, doesn't matter how talented you are, you're done.
Right.
If you have no talent, but you keep trying, of course, that's going to leave you in a tough place because people don't like your work. But even if you have both those things, you have to get a break. You have to get a lucky break, you know, and I do think you make your own luck. You know, I look back on things. I've made plenty of mistakes, but I'm not here to talk about those. But but no, I remember being in film school and I was working on a little Super 8 silent film and this young woman I was working with, she was applying to the Cannes Film Festival as an intern. And I'm like, that sounds cool. How do I do that? I applied. I did not get the job. I called the guy up who was a publicist. And I said, come on, you got to send me. I speak French. I'm a film student. I could be helpful. I could be a translator, whatever you need. Got the job. I went there, ended up meeting Oliver Stone as assistant. You know, like little things like that kind of work out if you don't give up, you know. I also had several years where I couldn't get a job. You know, I couldn't get arrested. I would get a freelance episode of a show, but I couldn't get staffed. I would have great meetings, but then nothing happened. And then, you know, actually when I got the job in The Closer, I've told the story a million times, but I met the showrunner, James Duff, after having a long week of rejections. And I was like a complete mope in the interview. I was like, whatever, you know, that's great. Sure. Nice to meet you.
Yeah.
I'm sure I'll get the job, but whatever. Thanks for the free water. And
we'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show.
He, for some reason, we still talk about to this day, he called my agent and said, what happened to this guy? And they said, ah, he's just going through a tough time. He can't get a job. He's so good. You know, we think he's great, but whatever. He's like, well, please have him come back and be normal. I want to make sure he's not crazy because I like his writing. So I went back. I was myself. I was, you know, I pitched some ideas and I ended up working on the show for like 7 years, you know, and we would joke about like, why'd you do that? Why'd you give me a second chance? And he's like, oh, I couldn't have done it. I'm so glad I did. It was good for me. I said, well, it was good for me too. So, you know, don't get down at things. Don't take things too hard. Every setback is only a pause before the next success, and literally be resilient. Just bounce back. Be nice and be resilient, because eventually someone's going to notice that and you'll get your shot.
Now, what is the lesson that took you the longest to learn, whether in the film industry or in life?
Still working on it. I'm still working on, you know, not getting too down on myself when things don't go well. I'm still working on, you know, as much as I present to my partners and my crew that this is the best thing ever and we're going to do great. There's always that doubt of, is this really a thing? You know,
imposter syndrome.
And, you know, at one point after we sold the last ship, one of the producers turns to me. I sold it in the room. Literally, Michael Wright said, let's do this. Let's shoot this as soon as possible. One of the producers turns to me afterwards and says, is this really a show? and all of a sudden I'm like, wait a minute. I have to write this, you know? So, and I don't need to hear that because I'm already hearing that myself. I'm hearing my grandmother saying, are you making a living? Like, you know, that kind of stuff. Like,
why don't you get a real job?
Yeah. So the last thing I need to hear is that you're an imposter. So it's hard sometimes because you really are putting yourself out there. I mean, in fact, the most frightened I've ever been was when the stakes were so low. I wrote a couple of plays, one act plays, and they were put together as a show in LA. I ran for like 6 months, like 10 years ago or more. And, you know, a small theater. And I remember being in the audience and being so anxious, couldn't sit still because I felt so exposed because it was me. I wasn't on a staff. I couldn't say, well, my boss rewrote me or, you know, this is what the network wanted. And it was my personality on display, my quirks on display, my thoughts on display. And, you know, it felt so great when people liked it. But at the same time, I hated the fact that I had put myself out there to be so vulnerable. But at the same time, that's what you have to do, right? And so how do you protect that piece of you and still present to the world in a business where, you know, people are cruel or, you know, God forbid you read the reviews. You work on something for 3 years and someone goes, yeah, it was all right. They should have talked to the Navy or they should have talked to, you know, like what? So I think that's something I'm still learning is how to keep a thick skin and also keep that part of you. I look back at that kid who used to read film comment at 15. I want to be Ingmar Bergman or I'd want to be, you know, and I think who's this kid from New Jersey who thinks he could be Ingmar Bergman. Right. So, you got to keep faith in yourself and surround yourself by people who are supportive and loving and, you know, and then turn around and hope that your kids like your work.
Exactly. Yeah. And last question, 3 of your favorite films of all time.
I would say Amadeus. Mm-hmm. Barry Lyndon.
Oh, wow.
And I would say the toss up between, this is a little pretentious, I know, but Ingmar Bergman's Persona or Godard's Contempt. Like when I want to get super inspired again, Amadeus, because I just love music. I love the way that film is directed. I I relate to Salieri too much sometimes. It's like a frog.
We all
you know?
Do. I think we all
yeah.
do.
Yeah. Barry Lyndon, I keep putting it on for people and end up watching the entire thing with them. It's the beauty of it. And then I love Persona and Shame by Bergman because they're just so stripped down. They're just about the faces and about the interpersonal stuff. And like I've borrowed from those movies in ways you would never expect for the stuff I'm making. And then the other kind of sort of North Star for me has always been Hitchcock because I like making films that are entertaining and popular and like you can eat popcorn and just enjoy them. But that if you wanted to, you could look deeper and find something into them. Like you could write a paper about them. You know, like Rear Window is a perfect example. It's just this great mystery story, but really it's about one guy who can't commit to a relationship, right? And he's paralyzed because of the cast. He's this beautiful woman who wants to be his girlfriend or wife. And what does he see out the window? He sees the young newlyweds. He sees Miss Lonely Hearts. He sees the sad sack. He sees the playboy. He sees the young couple doting on their dog like it's a child. All these things are sort of built into the story if you want to go deeper and realize the metaphors, but it's also just fun. And I think like that's to me great filmmaking where you're not sort of just saying, this is my message and being pretentious about it. You're telling a story first and foremost, you're entertaining right. people, but then there's depth beneath it, you know?
It's amazing that Amadeus and Barry Lyndon are the favorite films of the guy who just put Halo out. Like that's awesome. That is an awesome because you know, you're like, no, Blade Runner and this and that and stuff.
That goes without
The Godfather. We can deal with list them all off, but it wasn't a sci-fi heavy list, and that's what I love because that's where you get the more interesting stuff. Like you know, if you're gonna do sci-fi, when you start colliding genres and colliding ideas and you know things like that is remarkable. Steve,
I'll say one more thing. 2001 has always been one of my favorite films, and I was able to honor it in episode 2 of Halo. I was able to do homage to 2001 by casting Keir Dullea.
Oh, wow.
Who was such a joy to work with, such a sweet guy. Somewhere I have his autograph from a picture of 2001. But so, yeah, I like to be able to speak to film history. You know, you listen to Spielberg talk about the movies that he references when he makes, Indiana Jones, or whatever. It's the same thing. Now we're referencing those people, right? So the next generation. So I'm always trying to honor and pull from those greats, you know? So,
and someday some kid is going to go, Halo. I was watching Halo and I pulled a shot from episode 3. And that's
So, and I'll say that shot, that was an accident. We were running out of light and we had to do something. So,
and that's the funny thing. So when I've talked to some of these amazing filmmakers, I'll go, that shot. And they're like, oh God, that was horrible. So amazing when you see it from a different perspective.
Yeah.
But Steve, man, we could keep talking forever, but I appreciate you so much for coming on the show. It has been a joy talking to you. You are a mensch, sir. You are a mensch. So I appreciate that. I appreciate you. And thank you for getting Halo out, man. Finally bringing it out.
I hope you all love it. And honestly, I'm honored to even have been invited on the show. Looking at the people you've spoken to before me, they're all legends.
It's a
thrill to be even part of this, but I hope that I helped add to the conversation. And, you know, to anyone out there trying to get into the business, you know, welcome aboard, man. It's great. It's a great ride if you can get into it.
Thank you, my friend. I want to thank Steven so much for coming on the show and sharing his journey with us. Thank you so much, Steven. If you want to get links to anything we spoke about in this episode, head over to the show notes at bulletproofscreenwriting.tv/188. And I suggest you guys watch Halo. It is a fun, fun show. And if you haven't already, please head over to screenwritingpodcast.com, subscribe, and leave a good review for the show. It truly helps us out a lot. Oh, and by the way, I have a surprise guest coming on at the end of the month. I recorded her for about 4 months ago, and I've been holding on to this amazing interview just before her new show gets released, and it's going to be a legendary conversation, I promise you. So keep an eye out for that. Thank you so much for listening, guys. As always, keep on writing no matter what. I'll talk to you soon.
Thanks for listening to the Bulletproof Screenwriting Podcast at bulletproofscreenwriting.tv.